My name is Karen Blomquist, and this is the third session in a series. The Church Goes Public with What Manners is the title of this third in the series. In the first session, we basically did just some of the very basic kind of laying the groundwork of why it is important to think of the church going public, seeing justice as being far more central in our biblical tradition than we have often thought of it as being. And certainly that ties in with a lot of other voices that you've probably been hearing around the village this week and other times, John Schramm and others. One of the connections that I didn't get around to making there, but I think is especially an important kind of connection for Lutherans, is the fact that there are indeed some deep and important connections between justification, which is a very central kind of theological understanding in Lutheran theology, that we are justified by God's grace, and justice. And one of the things we've often forgot is that the Hebrew word that is usually translated justice or righteousness has to do with God's righteousness, but it also has to do with justice and shalom in terms of our social relationships with other people and with the rest of creation. So I'm especially interested in the work of some Lutheran theologians, and I'm thinking particularly of Rick Hordern up in Canada, who's done some work really trying to revive that connection between what we Lutherans have done a lot of talking about, namely justification and justice. And that understanding that certainly is pervasive in the Old Testament, but also an understanding that undergirds much of what Paul is talking about, which means that it's not just, you know, God saving us, but God justifying us, and revealing God's intent for the whole of creation. So it's not just an individual before God kind of thing, but it's how we live out that justified relationship with others. And so I think that's, you know, it's connections like those and a host of other connections that I think we need to be making far more clearly than we have in our theology in order to realize how justice and working for justice in the public arena is very central to what the church is called to be about. So if justice is central in what the church is about, and if the church is called to work for justice in the public arena, which is something we hear more about these days than we perhaps have in other periods of the church's history, although I don't think it's absent there either, then the question that I think we really need to grapple with, and I do see this being a grappling that I want us all to feel free to enter into today, we need to do some real grappling with what principles or tactics or what manners the church enters the public arena. And I think that's where some of the real controversy arises. People say, yeah, the church should be for justice, but how does the church go about that? You know, what is appropriate and what is not so appropriate? And question?
I believe in missionaries, the church supporting missionaries, but not commercial television. For reaching the people with faith and God and...
Okay. Yeah, I think that's
the church.
Yeah, I think that is somewhat distant from exactly what we're talking about here. I'm talking about the church challenging certain patterns of injustice in society. You know, speaking out in terms of the arms race, speaking out in terms of some of the government's policies in Central America or South Africa or issues like that. So, to me, that's the question that I want us to deal with. And especially, I think the question that kind of gets our attention is the question as to whether or not offensive tactics or offensive or manners, quote unquote, are ever appropriate for the church to use, and if so, under what conditions? I don't think that there is unanimity in Scripture as to the tactics that the people of God are to use in working for justice. Now, some of you might want to argue with me there and say, hey, there's a pretty strong strain, though, that talks about nonviolence. Certainly, if John Schramm were here, I'm sure he would want to argue that point. But I think there's more ambiguity regarding the exact tactics if we look at the whole of Scripture and how the people of God have worked for justice throughout Scripture. And even if there were a prescribed set of tactics, that this is how you should do it, the simple fact is that the social, economic, and political realities in our day are far different from what they were in biblical times, and therefore whether or not those tactics would be adequate, appropriate, etc. for us today is a whole other issue. What there is some clarity about is that the prophetic task of the church, when the church does seek to speak to the public arena and what's going on out there, the prophetic task of the church involves discerning what's going on in a situation from the inside. And therefore, I think it is very difficult for us to try to come up with certain abstract criteria that will prevail, you know, in all kinds of situations, or that can be abstractly applied from the outside. In other words, I don't think we can that carefully prescribe what should be done or what tactics or manners should be used beforehand. That kind of determination emerges when you're in the midst of the situation. And when you've tried this tactic and that tactic, and finally in frustration use what might look like as a somewhat confrontational tactic to those who are viewing it or judging it from the outside. And therefore, I'm aware that I don't think we're going to, at the end of this hour, come up with a certain narrowly prescribed set of tactics that are appropriate for the church to use. But I am hoping that we can at least begin to struggle and discuss together as we attempt to think through some norms or criteria that can guide us in deciding what to do in a specific situation. Otherwise, we as a church are likely at times to get caught in some pretty embarrassing situations without having done our homework. And I would submit as one of the examples of that, and in a sense it's the example where a lot of these issues have really come to the fore, especially for me, is the situation of DMS, the denominational ministry strategy, and the tactics that they used in confronting the situation of unemployment in the Pittsburgh area, and the particular tactics that they employed there, having gotten a lot of media attention and a lot of folks who really don't know anything about Lutherans getting a very skewed notion of what Lutherans are about on the basis of that particular event. Do all of you have at least some familiarity with what I'm talking about when I mention the DMS Pittsburgh kind of situation? How many of you do? Not too many. How many of you have at least seen or heard something either in your churches or on TV or in newspapers about? This is a situation that has resulted in the defrocking of two Lutheran pastors. It was based on a community organizing effort, which is why it's somewhat interesting, because it does relate a little bit to the kind of thing we were discussing in yesterday's session, which was looking at another example of community organizing. But the kinds of tactics and organizing principles that were used in the DMS in Pittsburgh were significantly different from the example we were looking at yesterday. Basically, what happened is a number of pastors and also some lay people about 1980 or just before that became very concerned, if not outraged, by the increasing situation of unemployment in the Pittsburgh area. The last figures I heard indicated there were 20,000 people laid off by U.S. Steel. I think the number has probably escalated since then. And so in many communities, there's just horrendous rates of unemployment and real devastation in communities that are so dependent on the steel industry. And so the churches tried to pull together and figure out what to do about that. Some of their early tactics involved things like setting up food pantries, which is one of the ways in which the church responds to social need that does not have a high degree of controversy attached to it. Before long, they realize, hey, this is like putting on a Band-Aid on a cancerous growth, and we've got to somehow deal with this problem at a deeper level than that. So they began to appeal to industrial and financial leaders in the Pittsburgh area and basically said, hey, look what's happening. Don't you have more concern about what's happening to the people? Well, they didn't get much of a response to that. They, in a sense, were appealing to people's goodwill and not necessarily organizing around some of the vested interests, but there was kind of an attempt to say, well, let's speak to these leaders. Well, it didn't get much result. So they adopted a tactic at that point, after having done an analysis of the economic realities in that area and realizing that Mellon Bank was one of the primary lending institutions to U.S. Steel. And therefore, when U.S. Steel took their money and invested it either in other industries or invested it in foreign countries, they said, hey, you know, why does the bank give them money to do this? And so they called then for members of the congregations who were experiencing all of this unemployment to make a pledge to take their money out of Mellon Bank as a kind of economic boycott of Mellon Bank. And they came up with pledges in the neighborhood of $5 million, which might sound a lot like a lot to us, but it didn't feel like very much to Mellon Bank. And Mellon Bank basically didn't change their lending policy. So it was at that point that they began, that DMS as an organization began to engage in some symbolic, confrontational, controversial tactics, at least tactics that were somewhat more controversial than an economic boycott, although for some people that in and of itself has controversy attached to it. And as they said in one of their documents, we need to engage in symbolic tactics to educate the congregation and to realize how outrageous, so that people can have their consciousness raised as to how outrageous some of these practices of the banks and corporations in this community are. And so they did things like depositing dead fish in the safe deposit box at the bank. They began to disrupt some of the church services of the corporation officials. They confronted some of the business people, some of the business leaders at their homes. And before long, they moved not only from a confronting of the business or corporation leaders, but they did further analyses and realized that their own Lutheran church was heavily intertwined with Mellon Bank in that area, and therefore they moved to a new level of tactics of confronting the LCA Synod in that area and engaging in some rather controversial tactics of directed against the bishop and other leaders within that synod. So a continuing kind of escalation. Now, one of the reasons I became interested in this is because about a year and a half ago, some of us at the seminary in Chicago, when we began to read about what was going on, and some of us having some commitment to the church moving into the public arena and addressing some of the sources of injustice, or at least attempting to do that, we became a little bit uncomfortable when the LCA ended up imprisoning one of the first of the Lutheran pastors who subsequently became defrocked, and defrocking him or imprisoning him not because of some theological reason per se, but basically because he refused to go along with certain constitutional provisions of the church. And there's a lot of details in this whole case that I'm not getting into, but just to give you, those of you who aren't aware of it, just to give you some sense of it. And so in the midst of that, as a seminary community, we began to have a number of forums on the situation and had some people who had been gathering information, trying to gather information from all sides in this controversy, which by that time had really become a controversy between this group that was using these somewhat outrageous tactics and the church, the LCA, on a synodical level, but also to some degree on a national level. And so we together, after meeting some time, about 70 of us formulated a statement, not saying that we approved of everything DMS had done, but raising some questions about the appropriateness of the Synod and the LCA doing what they had done to this pastor. And as soon as that was received by members of that Synod, we got no end of flack. This wasn't an official statement by our seminary, but it was a number of us who were just, you know, saying, hey, we need to discuss some of these issues more. And all of a sudden we realized that things had become so emotion-laden because of the particular tactics that group had used that it had passed the point of being able to sit down and rationally discuss the appropriateness of how the LCA had dealt with that. And I mean, we got all kinds of nasty, nasty letters, and lots of them, including letters saying that we as a seminary should be censored for having critiqued what DMS had been about. Since that time, it's become clear that our statement was one of the first to break the silence, and there's been more critique that has emerged now as to how the LCA dealt with that situation. But rather than going over all of the details of that situation, what it really community organizing effort that he was describing yesterday is something that I have not, it doesn't appear that they had too much patience at that level. But at the same time, I don't want to judge them so much as saying, hey, that points to the crisis that I think we face. How do we come up with some kind of criteria, some kind of principles to guide the church becoming public? I think there are certain patterns of injustice in our world today where coolly and calmly sitting down to discuss things is in and of itself perhaps not going to change a situation. And I think Paul Simon the other night was making it very clear that as far as he's concerned, things have reached that point in South Africa, which is why he is putting his support behind sanctions, feeling that the other methods have been exhausted. And if massive bloodshed is going to be avoided, economic sanctions are one of the things that need to be used. So I think there are various stages of, you know, when do you exhaust one tactic and begin to feel, because of what you faced, that the only alternative is a more controversial kind of tactic. Let me just stop and see if there's any questions about what I said. What I've said thus far. What I want to do is get into some beginning points of discussion for deciding what some of those criteria or principles might be. In other words, I'm not going to be sharing a finished, polished, you know, having it all pulled together, but something that hopefully we can use as a jumping off point for some more discussion.
I'm not sure if this is the place to put this in, but my thinking has been, as far as the Lutheran Church, that on a lot of controversial issues, that it does not take a stand, but it encourages you to, as individuals, decide mm-hmm. what you want to do. Now, is that right or wrong? I've always been kind of proud that it mm-hmm. was a church maybe that didn't, that encouraged you to think and make decisions for yourself, but that the pastor, at least the ones that I have known, did not stand in the pulpit
and say, you either believe this
and
way,
and say, or this is what we should be doing or we shouldn't do it. And mm-hmm. on most given issues, maybe not within the church much, but there's probably a lot of difference of opinion within a congregation. Mm-hmm. Is that basically correct?
I would say that's certainly a basic kind of principle that I think is one that I agree with. At the same time, I think there are certain crisis moments in a community, in a country, where it's not just a matter of saying, well, you know, this is the way it is, you kind of decide what you want to do, but things had reached a crisis point, for example, in the Pittsburgh area, where pastors were saying, hey, we corporately have to speak out against the devastation that is going on in our community.
And I'm thinking that, now I should have asked, and I didn't bring it up again when Dan Spencer was here with the talk about ordaining homosexual ministers. Now, mm-hmm. is this something that the Lutheran Church, and I realize when we say the Lutheran Church, there's more than one, but is this something that they have taken a definite stand, or is it just kind of tabled?
There is a definite stand against ordaining anyone who is openly gay, mm-hmm. or anyone who publicly presents him or herself as being gay.
Is it accurate to say that, or those who are practicing gay?
We've
fuzzed
around that
issue.
Right. Well, it
so
depends.
You can be gay, but as long as you don't do anything about it,
right?
As long as you don't act that out, then you're accepted. Then you can be ordained.
For purpose of this discussion, are we separating the church as, for example, Pittsburgh churches or local churches, church bodies, from the synod or the national church organization? I mean, you know, to distinguish positions taken by those various levels of church, are we making distinctions, or can we, or should we make distinctions in this discussion, or exactly where are we focusing?
I think there certainly are different kinds of actions that might be taken on those different levels, but I am talking about the need to develop some criteria or norms for the church to take action, you know, whether we're talking a local congregation, synodical, or national kind of level. Are there some distinctions there that you feel
well,
are important?
Well, I guess in looking at tactics, I guess, yeah, I would say there would be some potentially large differences between the kinds of tactics available to two or three local congregations versus, you know, the ALC and its investment portfolio, mm-hmm. or management or some other kinds of things, that, you know, investing in Mellon Bank or something. And, you know, I mean, there's the difference.
Much more clout. So a difference especially in terms of the kind of,
well, sure. And,
clout
and I guess you can establish different norms. The local congregation, as you say, exhausting several means, food banks and local kinds of things, you know, and then reaching a point of where either their power base runs out or, you know, whatever other resources they have available runs out. So then does the synod take over, or can the synod, you know, I mean, then that changes, that involves, I would think, another set of tactics or possible tactics and mm-hmm. validation of the whole process, and then again, up to the national level. So I guess, in my mind, there would be limitations in all levels and certainly suggest different tactics, different kinds of tactics. Mm-hmm. And so for this discussion, it would seem that we would, you know, maybe want to limit it a little bit to say, what are some possibilities that are realistic? Maybe at all three levels, but I mean, you know, realistic mm-hmm. possibilities that we could. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Back there.
In that situation, those congregations themselves do not go along with their pastors, correct?
In the case of the first pastor who ended up being defrocked, Doug Roth, who's the most celebrated example, his congregation, his church council did support him.
Remember,
yeah, well, there. There was a difference between, there was more opposition to his involvement in the congregation as a whole
than the church council.
Yeah, but it was the church council was for him, and the congregation, it was somewhat close, but I think there was a lot of opposition to him. I mean, even if it wasn't a majority, it was
a congregational
vocal
meeting where the majority present at the congregational meeting voted against the, but it was a muddy situation.
Yeah, and it just got muddier as things went along. In the case of the second pastor, who was officially defrocked, to use the popular word, at their synod convention in June, he was from a congregation that was not filled with the unemployed, as was the case of the first one, but it was an upper middle class congregation with a lot of corporation executives. He was not as, he did not bring DMS into the pulpit in the same way that Doug Roth did, but he was affiliated with the group, and that very much angered many of the corporation executives who were members of that congregation. And so it was a much different kind of dynamic operating there.
We have the voice. It's cumbersome. At least in the American Lutheran Church, the conference, and we had a pastor that presented that all pastors should have equal sound. You've heard that.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't fly in a conference. It was not voted for, but he had the privilege of going right to the district.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't fly there. It was not voted for. But I imagine he has that same privilege to go to the convention this fall and do it all over again. There is it's cumbersome.
Mm-hmm.
It is cumbersome.
Mm-hmm.
It's way behind the issue sometimes. But that, I think probably some of the resistance to some of these movements has been is that they bypass that process of bringing it before the group, the democratic way.
I'm curious, I disagree with that. And most of the processes I've seen, that's gone on for several years usually, where it keeps going down and down and down, because it's just a very small group of people that maybe have direct involvement or direct number of pastors that have direct contact with a particular issue. And they themselves then, or they and a constituency that they're a part of, have become increasingly involved in that issue or are not able to sit, you know, each year and bring it up and each year and have it voted down. And that doesn't seem to be particularly, so they choose some other direction as well. We think of people like Dietrich Bonhoeffer in the Confessing Church in Germany. You know, if he had simply followed that procedure and every year brought it up to the annual meeting, I mean, we would not remember Dietrich Bonhoeffer with any kind of regard at all. So that's not the only, that's legitimate and I think an early channel. But it's not, it can't be the only way that you deal with issues like that.
I've sat at many conventions where there have been many resolutions passed, and a few months later people say, well, what difference did it make?
Right.
And so I think the passing of resolutions is a not insignificant kind of thing, but many people are frustrated saying, well, is that sufficient?
Plus, whether or not debate on a Senate floor is reasonable and is an earnest effort at working on an issue. Our Senate has been so flooded with numerous issues that often we'll get to a major issue like sanctions on South Africa, and we've decided to limit debate, total debate, to 5 minutes. You did not get it. You don't get, that's not a democratic process anymore. That's just merely a hearing for an issue that you're not going to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think this brings up probably some of how people get so frustrated when you go against a body. You know, when the body seems content to do a hurry up and wait. And you're saying, we have this very important issue, and we can't wait a year, another year, another year, another year. Whereas the body sort of sits back and says, according to our way of resolving issues, you know, we need the democratic input from everybody. And there's a basis for that. But you get to, you know, when you get to some of these issues,
you either bang your head against the wall and go off and do something else, or you bang your head against the wall enough so you kill yourself. You know, I mean, it's that frustrating when you're right in there. And the systems don't respond. You know, they don't. You know, you go back to the civil rights thing. How long they were working, even after 1954. You know, when was the Washington March on Washington? Was that in 68? The big march on
66.
Something. You know, in my particular church, the minister commented the Sunday before that he wished he could, you know, he said he will be here. His heart was there, and you know, he spoke highly of this, the March on Washington and the support for it. Some old geezer who's a second cousin of mine was out the next Sunday distributing pamphlets as people came out of the first service and as it came into the second service, totally against Martin Luther King and the Civil Rights March and everything under the sun. Dr. Lee had the last word from the pulpit during announcements in second service. But you know, there, the church was not really out there, but a congregational leader was. And yeah, in the congregation there were some people who opposed it. But that, you know, there's a thing I think where this is a stand and this is justice. Mm-hmm. Did that pop off?
No, I just reversed. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But that, you know, that I think is one of our, a manner that an individual pastor, with or without the approval of the whatever boards they operate under, promotes as a social justice issue under the gospel. But you know, I don't know how long it took to make the appropriate statements through the official statements. But there are times when you just cannot wait and wait and wait for one convention after another. Issues have to, something has to get done, or else we're sound signifying bad noise, and a voice that signifies nothing.
I want to, as we're discussing this, just put up here some of the tensions that I think we have to deal with. And I think the way Lois has been articulating it is helpful, because I think our problem has more often than not been that of not taking a stand in the face of some really blatant injustice that goes on. And I think we have to be very clear about realizing that the moral vision of the church, or that comes out of our theological tradition, is not necessarily one that is democratic. You know, it is not necessarily, you know, the prophetic remnant is not the whole group of folks that includes everyone. And yet, how do we balance that so that it is not just a matter of, you know, someone taking a prophetic stand and that basically says, well, if you're not with us, then, you know, you're somehow beyond the pale, you're not Christian, or whatever. This is another area where I have some real problems with some of the so-called theological documents of DMS, in that I think there is a running throughout a tendency to say, hey, if you're not with us, then you're the Antichrist. They actually put it in those terms. In other words, you know, it's either or. How can the church at times discern where a clear case of injustice needs to be addressed and take a stand, and yet, and to do that in a somewhat corporate way, so it's not just an individual, but at the same time, allow the room for dissenting opinions without people feeling that they no longer are a part of that church, or that they are going to feel uncomfortable being a part of that Lutheran church?
You can fight a just war if it's defensive. Normally you have to be attacked first, or they argue about what constituted an attack. The means have to be commensurate with the, war is considered evil to start with. That's taken, it's sinful and evil, that's taken as a given. Is the means of the war going to outweigh the evil that would occur if you didn't do anything? Mm-hmm. I mean, if it is less than if you didn't act at all, then you're justified to act. If the action is going to cause more evil or distress than letting the war go, I mean, than simply surrendering, then you're not allowed to participate. So, for example, atomic weapons. on the means criteria, you could argue that to ever use means atomic weapons would violate the principles of just war, because nothing could come out of it that would justify the means that you would use. So that's one possible way of measuring it, is how much evil or confrontation, how to weigh that against the evil that you're combating, and also the likelihood of success. You can't say, well, the thing is so evil, like apartheid, that anything practically is justified, if whatever you do is not going to affect it. Mm-hmm. Then another criteria that's often used is the test of love. That is this showing forth love? Now, love is not sentimentality. It's not turn the other cheek, necessarily. But are your interests in bettering and helping the other person? And are you demonstrating Christian love in the process of doing it? And if you're not, then it's probably not an appropriate tactic. A third criteria that often is used is the question, does this obstruct the worship of God or participation in the sacrament?
We're called to be about, and what really is normative for how the church goes about what it's about. Now, certainly at that point, though, and I'm thinking now of a biblical scholar who's especially dealt with a lot of the prophetic literature, fellow by the name of Walter Brueggemann, who some of you may have read, who would insist that at times the church does need to use some unloving tactics. At times the oppressor must be ridiculed and not treated in a very loving way in order to be made reachable so that the oppressor can be disobeyed and history inverted. That's to quote Brueggemann. In other words, he's saying, sometimes a situation of injustice is such that symbolic tactics that cause the people to realize that that person or that structure is not God are appropriate to engage in. And so he would point to that as being a part of what the prophetic dimension of our tradition has involved, and certainly that's a part of the prophetic tradition that the DMS folks really grasped onto and said, well, we've got to ridicule Mellon Bank, and then when it became evident that the LCA Synod was kind of in cahoots with Mellon Bank, well, we've got to ridicule the Synod, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I have problems with that. We're not called to be ineffective. We're called to be faithful and as effective as possible within the limits of mm-hmm. being faithful. The problem with drawing on the prophetic tradition or the tradition of the Hebrew Scriptures in determining what's appropriate behavior is that you can justify the crusade, mm-hmm. you can justify genocide, you can justify a large number of tactics out of the Old Testament, which I personally do not think are Christian or acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I agree that it is sometimes necessary use tactics or means that some people will think are not loving. I think that ultimately the church is called, as a faithful church, to always try to judge its behavior in those standards. Because otherwise, Jesus would have behaved very differently than he did if he was going to follow the effectiveness as the world understood it in the first century.
Mm-hmm.
There is use of ridicule in the New Testament, very strongly, Jesus and Herod, the fox, with his ridicule of you have no authority, and just leaving it there, with the book of Revelation, which pictures the Roman Empire as the Antichrist, and as the demonic power that's in the world, and identifies it that way very specifically, and calls for non-cooperation with that empire. That's pretty strong stuff. There's that too. I'm also concerned about what you're saying about legitimizing behavior that shouldn't be legitimized. But there is that use of sarcasm and of ridicule.
But that's verbal behavior. And that's part of the prophetic.
Sure exactly
that's what that is part of the prophetic voice. You have to call when you see Antichrist, you have to call it Antichrist. But do you go out and bomb it then?
Yeah,
Well, what you're saying reminds me of what I was saying the other day of Bill Lazarus' comment at the Arslan. A Lutheran church is a maker of moral statements, but it's not a maker of moral strategy. And he was jumped on by all the third world bishops by saying that's easy for you as a upper middle class white American to say. Now that, on one hand, can be rhetoric on their part, and on the other hand, it's to point to a fundamental abuse that people in power have of the two kingdoms within could be, I'm not saying it is. But I always think about this when we were in New York, and I remember sitting in a long debate with Bill Weber, who was president of New York Theological Seminary and director of East Carlin Protestant Parish at one time. And he was more or less taking some of the same stances you were taking, and others who had just come back from El Salvador and Nicaragua were saying, would you tell that to the Sandinistas? Would you tell that to people in South Africa? So to me, there is an effective conversation that we have, but at what point, when the rubber hits the road, what do you do if your life is being threatened, and not your only your ideas? And now I don't think there's any answer, but struggle with it. In the same of DMS, would I ever put fish in a safe deposit box? I suppose I could. You know, I've never been threatened, but what I dislike about that kind of controversy is nobody ever said that putting a pink slip in a pay envelope was an evil act. But putting fish in safe deposit boxes were evil acts. Wasn't even a act. Would I toss pennies on the floor of my own bank? Well, certainly I would do that as a symbolic protest. So I struggle too, except I'm saying if I'm going to be effective, I might have to move beyond my own moral standards, or at least standards that I have inherited and in some way imposed on me to understand a breakthrough. And I, for the life of me, don't know what the answer is. It's only a hunch, it's only a guess. Even Luther is credited as saying, you know, I hope I'm right. In many cases he was. As we can say, in some respects, to the peasants' revolt, he made an error for theological purity in his own mind. And we live with that. But what would you tell, what would we tell those people in South Africa when Bill Lazarus said, well, we don't design moral strategy?
Well, let me say one thing, and then I think other people should jump in. When I was dealing with draft counseling in the Vietnam War period and dealing with people in the military who were trying to get out, they had to appear before boards, military panels, and the military panel would try to get them to refight the Second World War and the Civil War and what if the Japanese swam the Pacific and tried to rape your grandmother, what would you do? The fact of the matter is that we can only answer for the situation in which we find ourselves. When someone in Latin America, we are not in a position to tell the people in Latin America what to do. They have to answer to their own conscience, their own understanding of faithfulness. And you're right, there is no, we don't know, we have to work it out in the situation. God doesn't give us a blueprint, he gives us certain basic principles, and then we pray for the Holy Spirit and we have to make difficult decisions. And that certainly includes behavior that you might, if now you might not conceive of doing, you might be willing to do later on. But I think I was only trying to caution against using the Old Testament and or the Hebrew scriptures and some of its principles too readily, because
I was drawing the prophetic tradition, which I would not limit to the Old Testament.
But some of the prophets are, you know, telling to go out and kill all the Canaanites. So it's, you know, there is a problem that.
Yeah, and the part of that, the part of the prophetic tradition, though, that I think is helpful is the part that challenges the dominant ideologies and structures. And, you know, there's certainly a lot of connected with that I would have some. But one of the questions I want to raise, and maybe I'll get back, because I don't want to just to be on the edges here. I want to include everybody in the discussion. Can love ever be offensive? Can the strategies of love ever be offensive? I mean, love, obviously, you know, the end of love is not offense, but can the route to an expression or embodiment of love involve offensive tactics along the way?
Our children seem to think so.
Yes.
Say
our children, they have their own ideas about staying all night. Parents don't always agree with the confrontation there. About what our ideas of what is safe and theirs is.
Other comments?
Well, I think we can love another person regardless of the individual's moral standards. We can still love another person. We can love people whose moral standards may not be the same as ours. So, I mean, even though it may make it more difficult, then in some senses, you know, that kind of love is a little more offensive. You know? So, yes, I think we can. In a relationship that, you know, goes unbalanced to balanced to unbalanced and balanced again, you know, sometimes a love can be quote-unquote a tough love, but a really, and sometimes, like as you say, between children and parents, maybe a more offensive kind of love. But the underlying foundation, if it's strong enough, will persist in becoming, and as you say, the end result will still be that we love each other, you know, through it all, even though we may muddle through and, like I say, muddy the water and getting there.
So part of what you're saying is that the intent behind that specific tactic needs to be pretty clear. And better be pretty consistent with certain basic values.
I understand where you're going with it, certainly, yeah. I mean, I say I can love you and beat you over the head with a stick, but if I don't know why I'm being beat over the head with a stick, I might turn up and rear up and fight back, you know. So, you know, and children, in disciplining children, you know, you state the nature of the offense and hopefully come up with a punishment that fits the crime, and at the same time, in the name of love, try to, you know, set the record straight here, what we expect of the standards of behavior from that child, but all in the name and interest of love. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and there are other ways to do that. You know, blindly disciplining someone, it obviously doesn't give them a concept of why they're being disciplined. So, you know, you can compare and contrast those kinds of love, and the outcomes are completely different.
Some of you may need to leave, but seeing we have a little time on the table, we'll continue for a little bit, so if you want to go to the first setting, feel free to leave.
I think Christ was very offensive in a lot of his love strategies. I mean, he offended the systems, he offended the citizens, he offended the Jewish synagogue tradition, and a lot of his love and caring, he was offensive. And I think maybe we have defined offensive to be only a word that gets pigeonholed into a very negative definition. But I think we, you know, love often is offensive. And I think it has to be offensive.
Well, Mary had a session on offering sanctuary. And certainly the churches who do that are doing it out of love for the poor people needing it. And yet the other side, all right, they're showing love, but they are also breaking the laws of our country. And where are you on some of these? I think it could certainly be offensive. Mm-hmm. In fact, I can see, as Paul was saying the other night, that you can get caught in the middle, where yes, you're showing love and you want to do what's right, mm-hmm. but it's very hard to make that distinction.
That's a good issue. Mm-hmm. The sanctuary movement is an interest, is a church going public issue.
Mm-hmm. 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 A very key one, and.
Also, it's very easy to defend in terms of the Christian principles.
Mm-hmm.
But we have not heard from the church body corporate much about those things. As a matter of fact, LCA or ALC have a very hard time coming out stating we as a church are for this or that
mm-hmm.
altogether.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I suppose suing comes in yeah. too.
One thing I've been wondering ever since we've been mm-hmm. here. How practical yeah. of a thing is it to force a company to stay in business when they're losing money and a bank who is using other people's money, in other words, banks are failing now, how practical is that to basically you'd force the bank into bankruptcy at least at a given point?
Yeah, that's
how practical thing was this?
Yeah, one of the things that I've heard in terms of the analysis of the situation in Pittsburgh that DMS does now, it's not a matter of saying we need to somehow ward off all these plant closings. No, they to some degree are recognizing some of that as more or less inevitable. But at the same time saying at least companies could show a bit more concern to workers by giving them an advance notice, by helping workers to be retrained, and that sort of thing. The other way of answering that question is that many of those companies that are closing, it's not necessarily because they're not making a profit, but it is not profitable enough. It is more profitable to make, or you know, to make this product in the third world or wherever. And so it's not just a matter of they're not making profit, but somehow it's not profit that compares favorably with the rather dramatic increase in profit that occurred after World War II and, you know, for a decade or two after that. I've heard, you know, reports indicating that there was some profit. Part of what happened is the profit got used to buy up some other companies, to engage in some mergers, and therefore it wasn't used to employ more workers in steel, but to buy up some other industries. So it's, yeah, and the whole plant closing, the dynamics in that is a complex kind of thing. But I think at least one of the stances of the church in the midst of that is to say, okay, even if there are some economic forces that we aren't going to stop, nevertheless, what about responsibility to those who have been the workers for all of these years and who have, you know, spent 30, 40 years working for some of these companies and who have real family roots in that community? I could see we could go on and on, but thank you for, there were a lot of things, more things I could have said, but I appreciated the kinds of contributions many of you made.